This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, November 29th, 2011. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, in India, opposition lawmakers and small traders protest a government move to open the market to retail giants like Walmart. The U.S. Senate considers expanding interrogation methods with an amendment that critics say opens the door to torture. And as post offices face closures, we'll go to one rural Colorado town to hear from residents about the importance of the service in their community. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. NATO's chief in Afghanistan pledged to retrain forces to reduce the possibility that civilians will be killed. Last week in Kandahar, 7 more civilians were killed by NATO. 6 of them were children. U.S. Marine General John Allen did not publicly announce the retraining initiative, but sent a note to Afghan President Hamid Karzai, who made the email public. President Karzai also appealed to Pakistan's leadership today, asking them to reconsider their decision to boycott next Monday's conference on Afghanistan in Bonn, Germany, in protest of NATO airstrikes along the Afghan-Pak border last weekend that killed 24 soldiers. A NATO investigation is ongoing, but Pakistan maintains the attacks were intentional. Nigeria's Senate passed a bill today making same-sex marriage illegal and punishable by jail time. Sam Olukoya reports from Lagos.
The bill criminalizing same-sex marriage received overwhelming support from Nigerian senators. Some of them even called for the death penalty. But as passed, the measure mandates 14 years imprisonment for couples who marry. Further, the bill also prescribes 10 years imprisonment for anyone who helps gays wed, belongs to a gay club, or who supports gay activities. President Goodluck Jonathan is expected to sign the bill into law in spite of the strong anti-gay sentiment. The gay community in Nigeria has been growing in recent years. Sam Olukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
Lawmakers in Malaysia's lower house approved a bill today that would bar protest marches and make most stationary rallies illegal. Protesters rallied in the street today. Lim Chee Wee is president of the Malaysian Bar Council.
Processions in history, both in Malaysia and elsewhere, are agents of change. A procession is a demonstration by the people in motion to speak up about their grievances.
Under the new law, protests would be limited to stadiums and public halls. Both non-citizens and youth under 15 would be barred from participating. The measure is expected to pass Malaysia's upper house of parliament in the near future. France may soon be forced to allow genetically modified crops on French farms. The nation's highest court ruled Monday that the government does not have the authority to ban Monsanto's GMO corn without compelling evidence of likely harm to health or the environment. FSRN's Liam Moriarty reports.
France's Council of State, acting on a case filed by U.S. biotech giant Monsanto, overturned the ban on planting the company's BT corn. The corn has been genetically engineered to contain an insecticide that makes it resistant to some common pests. Greens in the European Parliament slammed the ruling. Michel Dupont, an aide to Green lawmaker José Bové, said the ruling underlined the need for a Europe-wide ban on GMOs. One country's ban is meaningless, he said, if neighboring countries allow the crops to be grown.
Like when you have a radioactivity cloud, and in the problem of Chernobyl, a border cannot stop contamination.
DuPont said the court ignored new evidence of potential risks of BT corn, including a recent Canadian study that found the corn's built-in insecticide in the blood of pregnant women and their fetuses. In a joint statement, the French Agriculture and Environment Ministries said they'll continue to look for other legal means to block BT corn from French fields before the planting season starts next spring. Liam Moriarty, FSRN, Normandy, France.
A member of Mexico's peace movement was murdered yesterday in the state of Sonora. Shannon Young has details.
Nepomuceno Moreno was shot dead in his truck Monday at an intersection in Hermosillo, Sonora. The 56-year-old was the father of a young man disappeared last year by men identified as police. Moreno was a member of Mexico's Movement for Peace, Justice and Dignity and was present during last month's talks in Chapultepec Castle between drug war victims and top government officials.
Los policías del estado. Tengo bastantes pruebas, videos que me tienen ocultados.
During those talks, Moreno delivered a case file to officials which he said contained key evidence about those responsible for his son's disappearance. He accused the government of inaction. He said soldiers began to patrol outside of his house after he publicly linked Sonoran police to the crime. Estimates for the number of disappearances in Mexico vary widely, but the peace movement puts the figure at around 10,000. Moreno's murder illustrates why many relatives are hesitant to go public with their cases. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Protests continue in India following the government's approval last week of a proposal that opens the door to foreign investment in the country's retail sector. The move would enable international retail giants like Walmart, Carrefour, and Tesco to open the retail stores in India, but it is facing stiff resistance. Opposition parties have stalled parliament with boisterous protests, and small traders have taken to the streets. Bismillah Galani has the story.
The Manmohan Singh government is already in a tight corner over its failure to control rising food and fuel prices. Its decision to allow foreign investment in the retail sector proved to be an invitation to more trouble. The opposition parties are unanimously opposing the move. As soon as the parliament convened Tuesday, the members of a united opposition were up on their feet once again, shouting slogans and forcing adjournment of the House for the sixth day. The opposition is demanding the government reverse its decision immediately. Murli Manohar Joshi is a senior leader with the main opposition, Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP.
This is a very lopsided and anti-people decision. Foreign investment in the retail sector is neither in the interest of the country nor in the interest of small traders and farmers. Multinational companies like Walmart and Carrefour have displaced people wherever they have gone, and many small farmers and traders are now protesting against them. We cannot hand over our retail trade to these companies. This is not acceptable.
Outside the parliament, small traders continue their protest against the decision. They say the entry of foreign companies in the retail sector will destroy their livelihood. Sudeep Shekhar is a member of a local traders' federation.
They will sell everything from water to cloth to mobile phones, and we will be automatically finished. The small retailers fear losing their entire customer base. Even now, when the foreigners haven't yet come, the customers think twice before going to a retail shop. They have a wider choice at the malls and prefer going there. Now, when everything will be under their control, the small shopkeeper is simply going to die of hunger.
The retail sector is the second largest employer in India after agriculture. An estimated 20 million people depend on it for their livelihood. A majority of them are small and marginal traders, like mom-and-pop store owners, hawkers, and street vendors. Shekhar says, besides displacing these groups, the multinational retail chains will also have an adverse impact on India's fast-growing economy.
Our economy is largely driven by domestic production. We produce what we consume ourselves, but the new arrangement will make us dependent on foreign goods, and eventually our self-sufficiency will come to an end. We've already seen what has happened to our cotton production and other things. So this, in a way, is a conspiracy to destroy our economy.
The traders have called for a nationwide shutdown strike on December 1st. To demand revocation of the cabinet decision. All the opposition parties have supported the strike, but the government shows no signs of backing down. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
Today, the Senate rejected an effort to remove several controversial proposals to the National Defense Authorization Act under review by lawmakers this week. It sets up more debate over torture and detention. The amendment from Senators Mark Udall and Jim Webb sought to remove sections that would allow indefinite detention of civilians and limit the rights of detainees. It failed in a 37-61 vote. Another amendment to the defense bill would permit methods of interrogation, such as waterboarding, that are widely considered torture. The amendment would supersede the executive order signed by President Obama in January 2009 that prohibits the use of torture by U.S. forces. Critics say it could bring policy back to the Bush era with an expansive and unchecked power that could violate international law. For more on this, we're joined by Jonathan Hafitz. He's a professor at Seton Hall Law School and the author of Habeas Corpus After 9/11, Confronting America's New Global Detention System. Welcome to FSRN.
Hi, thank you.
The amendment is number 1068 and has been introduced by Republican Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire. What specifically would it authorize?
The amendment would reintroduce many of the most controversial and illegal practices from the Bush administration era regarding the interrogation of detainees, and would effectively reinstitute the torture regime in terms of the U.S. national security policy. For one thing, it would roll back the President Obama's executive order on ensuring lawful interrogations that sought to ban torture. It would also erode a previous act that Congress had passed called the Detainee Treatment Act, which had passed by in 2005 and overwhelmingly in the Senate, you know, outlawing torture as well as cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment. And it would require the administration to adopt a secret annex to the Army's interrogation manual, which would be a way for torture techniques to be able to come back into the interrogations.
You mentioned a few effects of this amendment and changes. One of those is the rolling back of the executive order signed in January 2009 by President Obama. When he signed it, it was seen as bringing some clarity to U.S. policy on interrogation, and it stated that interrogation techniques are not to be authorized beyond the Army Field Manual. So what does that manual cover, and what would change here?
Well, what the manual covers is it provides guidance and instruction to military officers who are engaged in the interrogation of individuals who are brought into U.S. custody. And the manual itself is, you know, provides a kind of guide for lawful interrogations and for the U.S. to uphold its obligations under Geneva Convention. But the idea of a secret annex would allow for essentially secret interrogation tactics that that could be in violation of the Geneva Conventions to be put into place, and this option was actually rejected by the Bush administration Defense Department in 2006 on the view that such a secret annex would inhibit training and ally collaboration.
Well, what is this secret annex? How would it be created, and how would it be put into practice?
It would not be public, and there would be some interrogation techniques that would be legal in the sense of permissible by the manual that are given to interrogators, but they would not be, you know, the public would not know, what those techniques were, and so it's a way to, in effect, you know, smuggle in or allow for the use of techniques that are not merely, you know, controversial, but that may be illegal.
That amendment, again, is 1068 and being considered by the U.S. Senate. Jonathan Hafitz is a professor at Seton Hall Law School and the author of Guantanamo Lawyers, Inside the Prison, Outside the Law. Jonathan Hafitz, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Senate Democrats are also holding a vote this week to provide tax relief to working families that is paid for by taxing millionaires. Matt Laszlo reports on the effort to extend a payroll tax holiday.
Most of the attention on the supercommittee focused on its mandate to cut $1.2 trillion from the debt. But now that it failed, lawmakers are frantically trying to pass the job-creating policies that were also being debated inside the closed-door talks. The first policy to come up in the Senate is an extension and expansion of a payroll tax holiday. Rhode Island Democratic Senator Jack Reed says without it, families will face a burdensome tax increase while the economy remains sluggish.
First of all, if we don't pass that, that'll be a tax increase on working Americans if we don't pass the legislation.
Democrats want to pay for the continuation of the tax break by taxing any income over $1 million. Republicans have already defeated similar attempts to tax the wealthy this year, and Utah Republican Senator Orrin Hatch says Democrats are merely playing politics.
This is $260-plus billion, and supposedly financed by another tax on the so-called wealthy. It's not something that... It's an itty-bitty bill, and it's clearly political. I mean, it's not there because it's going to work. It's just clearly political. I'd be surprised if it passes.
If the payroll tax holiday is extended, on average, workers would see an extra $1,500 in their paychecks for the next year. But the legislation would make the tax increase permanent. While standing by the Senate subway, Hatch said majority Democrats are trying to sneak in a permanent tax increase.
And it's only for a year, and the millionaire's tax is permanent. I mean, that isn't the way to do things.
In the name of reducing the deficit, Republicans have demanded any temporary spending bills be paid for up front. And Senator Reed says instead of taking money out of other programs, a new tax just makes sense.
I think it's an appropriate pay for it.
As the Occupy Wall Street movement has further highlighted the growing wealth gap in the U.S., Democrats also think they have a winning campaign issue. Reed says average Americans support higher taxes on the nation's wealthiest citizens.
I mean, frankly, the vast majority of Americans recognize that this tax is fair. Because it's imposed on those people that are doing the very best at a time when people are doing many people are doing badly.
The payroll tax usually goes to Social Security, which has some Democrats worried the policy could become permanent and harm the long-term solvency of the popular program. West Virginia Democratic Senator Joe Manchin says he's wary of extending the payroll tax holiday.
I have problems with it. You know, truly creating jobs. I haven't seen where it's creating jobs. And it's basically putting a heck of a dent on Social Security.
In the past, Republicans have said tax cuts pay for themselves, and many have even supported the payroll tax holiday. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says Republican Leader Mitch McConnell is just trying to derail this latest effort in order to embarrass Democrats and the White House.
The payroll tax cut would put a lot of money back in the hands of businesses and in the hands of individuals. So the reason for the Republicans' change of heart, obviously, is simple. As Senator McConnell has said, his most important goal is to defeat President Obama. It's clear the Republicans will stop at nothing to achieve that goal.
The first vote on the extension of the tax breaks could occur as early as Friday. Matt Laszlo, FSRN, Washington.
Thousands of post office branches around the country are on a list for possible closure, many in rural areas. The Postal Service has been struggling financially and lost more than $5 billion this fiscal year. Earlier this month, post offices were given a temporary reprieve, but people around the country continue to voice concerns about the impact on communities. FSRN's Maeve Conran reports.
The post office in Ward, Colorado, in the foothills west of Boulder, is one of 11 facilities in the state on the list slated for possible closure. The question of financial viability in a town of only 160 residents put the former mining settlement's post office on the discontinuance list. Pat Seifer is the town's unofficial historian.
Actually, the post office was established in 1863, and it's the oldest continuously operating post office in the mountains.
Aside from the history, Seifer says the post office plays a crucial role in the community.
Well, for many people, it means just about everything in terms of their communication with the outside world. One of the things we don't have, and if you pull out your cell phone right now, you'll find out that you don't have cell service. Because there's so many ridges and dips and valleys and mountains, the waves just don't go through. So most people don't have cell phones. And the same thing is true for internet. There are only certain places where internet service works.
In winter, the post office can be a place for people to warm up and to catch up with neighbors and find out the news of the town. And of course, it serves its primary role of being a mail hub.
Good morning there, Greg. How are you doing?
Hi.
I'm surviving.
76-year-old Charlie Reutz says he goes to the post office most days.
Got to get the right key. Well, I might lose my box. I don't have a mailbox here.
Deliveries of medication make the post office a crucial part of his life.
A nice thing to do daily, you know, go get your mail. And it's nice to have a place where you can mail stuff. And so I'm hoping it stays open. I get a lot of medicine, you know. I order it and they mail it to me. So it's important to get your medicines.
The Postal Regulatory Commission is the authority charged with making recommendations to Congress with regard to the closures. Mark Acton is the vice chairman of the PRC.
Basically, what they've done is implement a number of parameters that they use to measure the viability of the rural and other post offices. And some of those criteria include revenue thresholds as well as proximity measures and those sorts of gauges.
Acton says the more intangible factors, like the role a post office plays in a community, are also being considered. He says the commission is looking at post office closures having a possible disproportionate impact on rural communities like Ward, Colorado.
In terms of, you know, that matter of societal benefits, where something that the Postal Service brings to the table that's beyond just delivery of the mail. It is, in many rural communities, a center point of the community where individuals gather and exchange information, and really it takes on a life that is different than what is typical of an urban post office. And those are important distinctions that the Commission and the Service need to keep in mind.
Colorado Senators Mark Udall and Michael Bennett have written to the Postal Regulatory Commission asking them to carefully consider the effects on rural communities and small towns. Earlier this month, Senator Bennett announced that the Postal Service was calling a timeout on the discontinuance process while these factors can be fully examined. The timeout may not stop proceedings to shut down the Ward location, but residents hope it will at least slow down the process.
I just am outraged by the idea that the Postal Service is being put into the hands of privatization.
That's Ward resident and town council member David Grimm.
It's called a service, not a business. The Forest Service doesn't make money. The public schools aren't expected to make money. And certainly the Defense Department isn't expected to make money. Why those of us that are the least able are being closed down is it's just beyond comprehension.
The public comment period for the discontinuance process ends November 30th. Earlier this month, a Senate panel passed a measure that would prevent the U.S. Postal Service from closing rural post offices. The measure, proposed by Senator John Tester, a Democrat from Montana, was added to the 21st Century Postal Service Act and prevents the closing of rural post offices until USPS establishes criteria determining whether a post office should be closed. That act is awaiting a vote by the full Senate. For FSRN, this is Maeve Conran.
Across the country, tuition hikes at public universities are proposed or going into effect, and critics say threatening the foundation of public education. In California, students went on strike Monday at UC Davis, and faculty members joined protesters at campuses in Los Angeles and Merced as the Board of Regents met to consider tuition raises throughout the university system. In Tampa, students gathered at the University of South Florida to protest a 15% annual rise in tuition. And in New York, despite months of protests, CUNY's Board of Trustees voted 15-1 to approve a 30% tuition hike. Students will now pay $300 more each year through 2016, when the cost will be nearly $6,400 for 4 years of undergraduate studies. Community News Production Institute reporter Jessel Knorr has more.
We say student strike. They say tuition hike. We say student strike.
About 1,000 protesters gathered outside the Brugge University campus building. Students and some faculty demanded that university trustees, who were meeting inside, take the tuition hikes off the table. Classes were canceled after 3 p.m., and police used barricades to keep protesters at a distance.
Mr. Barrett,
18-year-old Hunter College student and Occupy organizer Alexi Shalom said the tuition increases will disproportionately affect low-income students. Shalom says the budget shortfalls could be averted if the rich paid a bigger share of tax revenue and tax loopholes were closed.
There are obviously budget shortfalls, but those shortfalls do not need to be picked up by working class students. Those are the last people who can afford to pick them up. I would rather suggest that we reimpose the millionaire's tax, reimpose the stock transfer tax, and while we're at it, if we're really going to talk about cutting CUNY, how about cutting the administrator's salaries? You know, the chancellor of the Board of Trustees, Matthew Goldstein, makes $500,000 a year plus benefits.
The CUNY faculty union also opposes the tuition hike. Anthony Alessandrini, associate professor of English at Kingsborough Community College, said keeping tuition affordable is part of a bigger fight for a democratic public education system.
But I would want to say that it is also a struggle against a top-down university administration, specifically the Board of Trustees and the Chancellor's Office, that is not democratic. It's essentially politically appointed. Students being pushed out of their own building. And today, as you may have seen if you've been at Baruch, students being told essentially that they're locked out of the building on their campus is, I think, just the latest example of an administrative policy that's about pushing students out of having any control over their own education.
New York City Councilmember Charles Barron of East New York was among several local politicians who has voiced his support for the protesters. He confronted police as they used motorcycles to aggressively pursue students as they marched through the streets.
They run, I didn't want them to run the scooters into the students, so get them little scooters off the streets, take down the barricades, and we'll go in front of Baruch College.
Barron, also a CUNY alum, argues that an economic downturn should bring increased funding to public education rather than cutbacks.
With all of this unemployment out now, this is the time for working class people to get degrees, skills, and that's why CUNY is essential. It was free when I went, it should be free now, and they shouldn't be hiking no tuition.
City and state officials say the tuition increase is needed to close a multi-million dollar budget shortfall. In a statement, CUNY Chancellor Matthew Goldstein said the tuition increases have, quote, cleared the pathway for present and future generations to benefit from access to a quality higher education. But Sarah Pomar, an organizer with the group Students United for a Free CUNY, says the fight will continue for a more equitable higher education system.
It's a defeat in the sense of legislation, in the sense that we have to pay more tuition, but I think we need to be very optimistic of the organizing and the level of radicalization that we've experienced through Occupy Wall Street. I think what we need to do now is just regroup, speak about really what the role of campus security, police, the Board of Trustees are within our institutions and in society as a whole, and we need to just build bases, try to kind of remind people that, you know, the fight is still ongoing. The vote always happens, but the struggle always needs to continue.
Outside a public hearing last week, police used batons to beat students and faculty as they attempted to enter a public hearing. More than a dozen students and faculty were arrested. During Monday's demonstrations, police arrested four students. Jessel Noor, FSRN, New York.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Matt Laszlo. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Janine Etter and Shauna Ray. FSRN is largely funded by listeners like you. Find out how you can support independent journalism during our Clarity in the Chaos campaign. More information is available on our website at fsrn.org. Thanks for listening today. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marino.